By 8 o'clock, Rodman had not returned. The phone had rung twice. The first time, a voice said, "Hank, it's Montauk at 2 on Monday," without waiting for an answer. The second time, a caller said, "Hello?" And when I answered yes, the person hung up. Grabbing a cab on West End Avenue, I told the cabbie, "Washington Square, Barney Gallant's place." "You ain't old enough or rich enough," replied the cabbie. "We'll see." At Barney's, a doorman looked at my casual clothes, sniffed, and asked if I'd reserved a table in advance. I handed him Rodman's card and told him to show it to Barney Gallant. He disappeared briefly, returning with a smile. "Right this way," he said. "Mr. Rodman hasn't arrived yet, but his table's being held for him." He turned me over to an unctuous waiter who led me to a linen-covered table with fine silver set for two. "Mr. Rodman," he explained, neglected to say a third party was joining him. "I'm his sister, from out of town. It's a surprise." "No trouble at all, none whatsoever," he said, preparing a setting for me and moving away. The Club Gallant, situated on the south side of Washington Square, number 40, occupied the lower floor of the building and was decorated with panels bearing the likeness of noted socialites and actors. The joint reeked of wealth. Although the village housed mostly artists and bums, some people said they were one and the same, Barney's place attracted people dressed to the nines. Tall silk hats and coattails crowded the opera-style boxes, which replaced the usual tables and looked onto the stage. Eyeing the crowd, I saw Masseria and Zucania walk in, so I slid down in my chair. But they spotted me and came to my table. "Hurt your back?" said Masseria. They both sat without being asked. "No, what gives you that impression?"
"The way you were slouching."
"Just hitching up my underwear."
"I know some dames that don't wear none."
"We're missing a diamond," said Zucania. "We wanted to talk to you about it. Your mother said you returned to the city."
"Diamond? I turned them all over to you."
"One was glass," said Zucania.
"How come you come back to New York?" asked Masseria.
"Aor offered me a job I couldn't turn down."
Masseria scowled. "You want to tell us about it?"
"Contact Aor. It's not up to me."
"Listen, kid," Masseria angrily interrupted. "It's up to you to cough up the diamond. It was in your care. If you don't, your boyfriend and mother are dead."
Zucania apologized.
"I wish I could help, but I can't." "We should have hung on to you when we had you. Influenza, my ass. You look healthy as a mule."
"I recovered."
"Well," said Masseria, getting to his feet, "you'd better recover the ice before we ice your lover boy and mama. And you ain't got much time."
"I'll pick up your tab," said Zucania, replacing his chair. "The evening's on me." Before leaving, they stopped to talk to the waiter. I saw Zucania hand him some green. "Thanks for the kindness, boys." For almost 2 hours, I sat trembling, waiting for Rodman. The skits, which Barney Gallant introduced, diverted me only slightly. Seeing Hank and Lily arrive, I waved. Even across the room, I could hear her falsetto laugh and throaty voice.
"Wow, look who it is!"
Like two ballet dancers, they tiptoed among the crowded tables and pirouetted up to my chair.
"What are you doing here?"
Lily burbled.
"Waiting for you."
"At Barney's?" "Carolyn Rothstein's idea." Dressed in evening clothes, they said they'd just been making the rounds, Park Avenue, Broadway, and now the village. Lily removed a black silk cape and Rodman a top hat. I noticed that his gray spats matched his cane.
"You look drawn," said Lily, changing from frivolous to serious, as she often did, in the blink of an eye.
"Something I ate. Don't worry, it's nothing." I forced myself to be cheerful and never once let on I was in a terrible pickle. AR would have been proud of my discreetness. Geez, did I need to talk to him.
"I can't tell you how delighted I am to see you," Lily enthused as the two of them settled in at the table. "The last time we saw you was in the country at that rustic farmhouse. You are on your way to Cape May.
Quite a trip, Hank remarked flatly.
You must, Lily gushed. Tell us why you're here.
Bill Fallon is trying to reach Hank. It's important.
Rodman's smile immediately fled. Furrows creased his forehead.
Please excuse me. This may take a few minutes.
He hastily moved toward the lobby.
Such secrets, exclaimed Lily. These men, you never know what they're up to.
When does Hank's case come to trial?
The end of next week, answered Lily, the gaiety suddenly gone. He's hoping it won't take more than a day.
Do you mind if I go with you?
I'd love to have you along, someone to talk to.
Tell me about Cape May. Looking downcast, she soberly measured her words.
I picked the Windsor Hotel for a reason. It's where Brad stays with his whore. He took her there for that weekend. I knew it, but never told Hank. When we pulled up to the curb, I could see Brad's gray Avondale touring car parked just across the street.
While Hank unloaded the trunk, I booked the room.
You could have run into them both.
I was rather hoping I would, but I didn't. That came soon enough. I asked the desk clerk for their room number. He said 411. Even-numbered rooms are on one side of the hall and uneven on the other. I explained that the couple in 411 were friends of ours and that we hoped to surprise them, so it was important the desk clerk not give us away. When I asked if room 409 or 413 was free, he said the latter. I signed the guest book, Mr. and Mrs. Hank Rodman.
The Windsor Hotel, continued Lily, is a sprawling four-story clapboard affair furnished in late Victorian. We stayed on the top floor and had a lovely view of the ocean.
May I take your drink order? Asked our waiter.
Both Rodman and Lily were teetotalers, which Lily said always gave them an advantage at parties because they knew when to be silent and when to be free, timing their outspokenness so that everyone else was too drunk to notice. Lily replied, crushed mint and ice for two and...
Make mine ginger ale on the rocks, I quickly added, wanting to hear the rest of the story.
Bring a seltzer bottle as well.
It sounds to me as if you didn't go to Cape May for the fun.
No, I went to catch that son of a bitch red-handed.
What happened?
Hank complained about the noisy couple next door. He said the sound reminded him of a butcher slapping a slab of meat on the chopping block. When I heard her greasy grunts, I insisted we change our room. The desk clerk charged us for both rooms, but Hank didn't seem to care. We took one down the hall. The next morning, I rose early. When Hank asked why the rush, I said that I wanted to spend a long, leisurely breakfast in the quaint Victorian dining room, where I sat with my back to the door. When Brad and Gertie came down for breakfast, I could hear her whinnying laugh and Brad's husky voice. From across the room, I could hear Brad order bacon, eggs, and waffles. When the waitress brought him his order, he barked that he needed the syrup. I grabbed the bottle from the sideboard, came up behind him, and poured it over his head. He howled and wheeled round in his chair.
Yes? I asked calmly.
Where did you come from? I mean, how come you're... I can explain.
No need, I said, smiling sweetly, and slowly returned to my table.
Brad followed me, his hair matted with syrup. He pushed his face close to mine and said he wouldn't be spied on.
You're making a scene, I replied.
I'll get to the bottom of this.
You're already at the bottom. Just look at yourself and you're floozy. You can't sink any lower.
Brad glared at me. He radiated pure venom. Before he stormed off, I thought he would kill me. At that moment, I swore to change my life. I knew I'd made a terrible mistake. Now I intended to correct it. The waiter bought three glasses, my ginger ale, two crushed mints, and the seltzer. As I stirred the cubes with my swizzle stick, Lily completed her story.
We checked out and took a small room in a private house in Old Cape May, where we spent two glorious days reliving the past. I never told Hank what had happened.
She pressed the lever on the seltzer bottle, shot a stream into her glass, and drank it straight off. When Rodman returned to the table, he looked grim. The juror Fallon had bribed, and Mr. Charles Rendig had blown the whistle. But it was Rendig's word against Fallon's, since Bill had paid him in cash. What had looked like a piece of cake was turning into scallions. Rodman had promised Fallon to meet him early the next day in his office. "For now," Rodman giddily declared, as he siphoned seltzer into his mint, "let's drink up. Tomorrow and all the tomorrows will come soon enough." It was unlike Hank to sound fatalistic. He was usually full of promise and hope. His romantic readiness to sail in search of a new India seemed suddenly becalmed. The failed bribe must have spooked him. We sat there studying our glasses, wanly smiling at each other, when a loud greeting broke the mood. Old droopy-eyed, big-eared, legs diamond, sporting a Panama hat, had made his way to our box. "This the dame you been telling me about, Hank?" Rodman looked ill. Without enthusiasm, he said, "Lily, Jack, Jack, Lily." Legs pulled up a chair. Rodman had the waiter bring a bottle of scotch, another glass, and ice. As Legs slowly sipped his drink, a buxom blonde sidled up to our table and greeted Legs.
"How do you like to get friendly? You know, have a drink, go to my place, make a little whoopee."
Lily moved her chair to face the stage, showing us her back. I felt sorry for Hank.
"Look, will you scram?" said Legs.
But the woman persisted.
"I ain't interested."
"You don't know what you're missing," she said, leaning over and pressing her breasts against him.
"Look, do I have to belt you one? I told you to scram."
"All right, if you feel that way," she said, giving Legs a contemptuous look. "I'll just leave you alone. It's your life."
Legs seemed oblivious to Lily's disdain.
"What you been talking about?" he asked offhandedly.
"Cape May," I replied.
"Really?"
he said with enthusiasm. "We had a guy working for us there."
"Yeah, you told me." "Maybe your friends would like to hear."
With Lily refusing to enter the conversation and Rodman looking dyspeptic, I tried to redirect the conversation to the stage show. Abruptly, Lily announced she had no interest in the last couple of skits. The party broke up. Out on the street, Legs went one way, the three of us another. Hank had parked at the end of the square. I sat in back and Lily hugged the passenger door in front as Hank drove the yellow circus car up Broadway past the admiring crowds. For most of the trip, the atmosphere inside the car must have reminded him of waiting in the trenches for the next shell to land. When we reached Columbus Circle, Lily exploded.
"Don't you ever again, I repeat, ever again, expose me to people like that. I was mortified."
Hank, desperate to explain, jabbered, using words like wings to keep him aloft.
"It's just for now. I promise you'll never have to see him again. Once I have enough, my goal is a million and I'm not far away. I'll quit and we can live wherever you like, just as we planned. I promise, Lily."
Although I was sitting behind her, I could hear Lily sniffle. In a tick, she slid over next to Hank, put her arm around his neck, and rested her head on his shoulder. She remained this way, saying nothing, until we reached 84th Street, where she disengaged herself long enough to turn and bid me goodnight. He gave me a wink. I could see she was anxious to return to Hank's nest, have a good cry, and then make up in his arms.